No, well, I think in a sense what we're doing really is in this inquiry into the different levels of being a human being. And John's idea early on of learning a new language is that we're learning to enter into dialogue with ourselves, with each other, with the universe, and learning to trust that living dialogue, I think.
Strikes me as learning the language of how to think about thinking. Because when I was at school, the teachers were Jesuits mainly, who they weren't concerned about right and wrong, surprisingly enough. They were more concerned about accuracy, precision, exactness. The truth was only in the argument that you presented. The argument didn't need to be right or wrong, didn't need to lead anywhere. But they challenge you to demonstrate how you got from A to B to C to D and persuade people that you had done so in a coherent manner. So you could think what you liked. You could go where you wanted, as long as you could show a consistent trail of how you got there.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, that's a really important thing, isn't it? Because it's the authenticity of the search, of the inquiry, and the ability to communicate that with each other, really, so that we can learn from each other. It's really, really important, I think.
I know they're very hot on visualising. It must have been to do with the...
God, of course they would have. The existential ignatius of Loyola, of course they would have been, yes.
They're very big on visualising precisely where you were. You know, you have to ground your thought in a very real world. You couldn't float off anywhere, which is kind of surprising because they were godmen. You don't expect them to. That's an aside, really, but it's a reflection.
It's an interesting aside, though, isn't it? Because actually the thing that is true about Jesuits, and if you read the writings of St. Ignatius of Loyola, there is a real precision. There is a lot of work on the embodying of images and the kind, you know, so it's interesting, of course, that works through into more secular places. You would want it to, and you'd expect it to, I suppose, because if it's going to be something central to people, you'd want it carried through everywhere. So it's interesting you had that experience in a way.
Because he did say that man in the attitude of prayer and he'll soon feel like praying, didn't he?
Totally.
Ultimate embodiment, isn't it, really?
I really like Ignatius of Loyola. If you can handle the Catholic imagery, which is not easy, to be honest, but actually there's somebody who really did know about the embodiment of spirituality of a particular form, you know, so it's... Because in a sense, that's kind of what this act of embodiment is really what we're focusing on. And I suppose the what we've looked at this weekend is using a form that I've used for nearly 50 years, really, I suppose. And it's a form, that, you know, this form of the name and the Hebrew letters. It's something, of course, I use because it's part intrinsically part of me. It's kept, you know, I've put it down, it comes up again. So it's got an utility. I have confidence in it. It's not special because of what it is, except that it's something that I really know. I couldn't do, you could probably do stuff like this, I was saying earlier, with the Chinese letters or the runes. But I don't really know those and they're not part of it. I could make a stab at the runes, but it wouldn't be authentic. Because where are we now? Wait a minute, let me just ask myself that question. What am I doing here right now? I suppose what I'm addressing, what we're addressing this weekend and what we'll continue to address in the three final weekends of this training, is this act of being the Grail. What does it mean to be the Grail? How can we be the Grail? What helps us to be the Grail? And what helps us to sustain that kind of presence in a world that actively works against it. Now, that the thrust of the world is to be on the surface. And that's why, you know, we were talking earlier in the weekend about words that were once beautiful, like mindfulness, have become toxic because they get co-opted, they get taken into a surface and become the opposite, actually, of what they're meant. And in a way, that's a good image for the environment that we find ourselves in. So if we're going to be the Grail, if we're going to be this kind of generative source working in cooperation with ourselves and with the universe, then we have to look at, well, what helps us to sustain that process? And I suppose part of what I'm offering here really are the things that have helped to sustain me, and that principally relate to working with intention, working with image, working with energy, and working with embodiment. And the forms that are used this weekend are some of the most central forms that I've used in my own work. The word yud-heh-vav-heh, which has been central this weekend, I like because, as I said earlier, it's an entirely paradoxical thing. It means it represents the generative source, the divine. But it's a word that cannot be pronounced. It's a central word. I mean, in terms of Judaic or Judeo-Christian tradition, this word keeps on emerging. The word Jesus, for example, which we find in the New Testament, is Yeshua, which means the salvation of Yud-Heh. So the name of Jesus can be said to be Yud-Heh Shin Vav-Heh, one way of understanding it. But the name itself represents the nature of being. The actual literal meaning of it, Yud-Heh Vav-Heh in Hebrew, is to be. So it represents the nature of being, the nature of that deep place, whatever we mean the deep place to be, the place that is beyond opposites, where opposites are continua. The word itself, yud-heh vav-heh, is itself a joining of opposites, because one of the ways of understanding the four letters, the yud is said to be the father, the first heh is the mother, the letter vav is the son, and the final heh is the daughter. Now, we don't have to get too hung up on that, but it represents, this one word represents being male, female, young, old. Parent, child. So it's and if you like, behind it or underneath it or on top of it, you have this mischievous flaming letter Shin, that in itself represents this idea of the divine breath that cannot be contained, that can take any form, that is like this fire that is continually creating and destroying. So the conjunction of the name and the letter creates for me a sort of a mandala. And that mandala we began with, both in its geometric shape and in its letters, represents this place where opposites conjoin, things come together. Now, the other thing that's come into the workshop this weekend has been these four figures of the winged man, the winged bull, the winged lion, the winged eagle. And these are related. These four figures are said to be hold the letters of the name. So the lion is the yud, the first hay is the eagle, the winged human being is the vow, and the final letter hey is the winged bull. Now, these are, again, within Judeo-Christian tradition, these are universal symbols. You find them from in the vision of Ezekiel. They're also symbols for the four evangelists. So, you know, so Saint John is the eagle, Saint Mark is the lion, Saint Luke is the man, and Matthew is the bull. I think that's right. And so you could go around the corner to St. John's Church and you will see the images of the man, the bull, the eagle and the lion just on churches. And many churches have them. Having them they're up on the tithe barn, the Glastonbury tithe barn as well. And that's because they're regarded as primal energies. But they're also, in the Kabbalah, these living beings that you can talk to. So, the symbolism or the ideas behind the name and the holy living creatures is something that focuses our attention right on the source of things, right on the deepest place of things. If you look at the name when it's done vertically, it's also described as the image of a human being, where the yud is the head. First hay is like the shoulders. The vav starts in the heart and goes down into the pelvis, and the final hay is the sort of hips and the legs. So it's also said to be the image of a human being. So it holds really this kind of this extraordinary idea of everything, and we have these images of these beings who can be these vast beings, but who will talk to you, who you can befriend. And it is also the image of a human being, you. So it brings us into this place of encountering us, the deepest, biggest parts of ourselves. And it's also saying, well, it's just here and now you as well. It's also when you contemplate the letters of the name, as you start to see, they change shape. They're pictographs, so they start to move. So they're these peculiar, if you like, Hebrew letters that you might think you would have to kind of, you know, learn a lot of Hebrew to understand. But actually, what happens is they start to talk to you, just as you look at them in an external image. They start to shift around. They acquire texture and movement and create relationship with you. In a very, you know, very powerful way is just to hang out with the letters, chant the name, talk to the four holy living creatures, and see what comes back at you. I mean, I was talking to them earlier on when you guys were, and the lion said to me, it's important you tell them that the yud is about the creation of will and intention. And the eagle said, but the hay, first hay, is about the creation of flow. Whereas the man said, the human being said, and to the vav is about joining together in dialogue. And the bull said, but the final hay is about crystallization.
So the man's for dialogue. Dialogue.
Man says it's about dialogue and dialogue, inquiry, but with energy. So it's about energy. So we could say intention, flow, energy, crystallization. And there's lots of, but that's just an example of just something that's just sort of happened, right? As you kind of work with these things, you become the befriended, and and you enter into, this is the language really that John was talking about, where you start to create, this is, I'm sharing something of my internal language and with you around this, but if you kind of find this useful and engage with it, it'll start to talk to you in your language. And it's crucial, this is not about learning Hebrew. My Hebrew is very, I'm not bad, but it's quite patchy. And that isn't the language. You're not trying to learn Hebrew. Big mistake people make about the Kabbalah is they think they have to learn Hebrew and become Hebrews. It's not that. You're learning an internal language. It just happens to be a mystical system that uses these pictographic things. And you can know nothing about it and be a very profound Kabbalist, and sort of, and because actually, what's being learned is the internal language. The actual meaning of the word Kabbalah is from mouth to ear. It's like a whispering between the worlds. So, what does it mean? Well, it means whatever happens in the dialogue between you and it, you and them. Another way of understanding the letters of the name is that Yud, as I say, is about intention. It's about will. The first He is, you could say, about imagination, about the kind of creation of the living image. So the Vav is about the coming together of intention with the living image to create life, a living form. And the final He is about the embodiment of that image.
So would you like to put that on the tree?
No. Why do you want to put it on the tree?
Well, I'm just thinking because one could, but then that's too packed.
It becomes too complicated. No, that's right. So that's the problem here, right? So no, I wouldn't. Because it's interesting that about Tree of Life is I love the Tree of Life. You know that, do I've used it a lot with you, but it's not the be all and end all. It's not even in the Kabbalah is it the be all and end all. So the what kind of Kabbalah I'm looking at now is actually simpler than that. It actually uses the letters of the name.
I suppose my thinking would be that I think of the tree as the glyph of the universe.
Yeah.
So everything will fit
onto
somewhere.
It would do. Yeah. I could do it. It's not that I can't.
It's helpful or not.
No, exactly. It's not that I can't do it. I absolutely could do it. But actually, we then be trying to juggle two symbol systems in our head together.
Yep.
And actually, this in itself is enough. Really, you don't really need. You don't really need the tree. In some ways, you could see, if you can look at the letters of the name, the Yud Heh Vav Heh, the Shin always represents everything. It's the sort of the random factor, right? So it's the mystery before manifestation. Now, the letter Yud Heh Vav Heh, in different ways, represent processes, flows, possibilities of movement. So another way to understand the Yud Heh Shin Vav Heh is to see the Shin as that mystery, the generative mystery. The Yud would be the field of stars. The Heh would be the solar system. The Vav would be the planet Earth. The Heh would be you standing here, embodying all of that, bringing all of that down. So there's a way of a way of thinking and playing with these things that creates that kind of inner language.
But it shouldn't be fixed.
It can't be fixed. Once it's fixed, it dies. Yeah. Right? Because actually, we're playing with something. In fact, in this room, you see that picture? You might need to see this properly. This picture here is a depiction of the four levels of the name, with the Shin right in the center. The little blue star right in the middle, right at the center point of the diagram, represents the letter Shin. The Yud is the green and yellow cube. The first He is the golden cube that surrounds it. The Vav is the pink and the blue cube that surrounds that.
And the final hay is the great big blue cube. Do you see that? And it's a sort of six-pointed kind of figure, and with a Star of David in the centre as well, which we're up against. Star of David always reps the two triangles interlocking. So there's a lot. So that's it's made by a great, now dead Hasidic artist from Safat in Israel, so whom Ali and I met, God knows how many years ago.
He also did the blue one.
And he, yes, and actually, if you come and look at the blue one for a second, it's around the corner here. So that represents structures and modes of expression nested, each one nested within each other. Mm-hmm. If you look at this, you get the dynamic of the nail. So in a sense, if you, the letter shin is right at the centre, rippling out through all of creation. And if you look at that for any length of time, it starts, and the same with the other, the letters start to shift. The images start to shift. They're living images.
They're pulses, aren't they?
They pulse, that's right, exactly. That's great.
It just went completely dark on me for a minute.
Yeah, it can do that. That can happen as you look at it. Because it's again, this is part of the inner language, right? These are the things that, because these are moving shapes, whether they're letters or images. It's drawing on this same idea that we're discovering that we are constantly in dialogue with the universe. And when we clear, if you like, our resistances and our habitual ways of being out of the way, we find ourselves dialoguing with this kind of quantum light flux, where things are one thing and then another thing, one thing and then another thing, wave and particle. But you know, that's kind of, you know, so the images I've given you about the name kind of have a stab at that. His Yaakov's images here are ways of also depicting that, because they both have their own form, very precise. They're both very precise things. Okay, the geometry of this, if it's only slightly out, would be complete, would screw the whole thing up totally. But so there's enormous precision here, but that precision creates the flux, creates the quantum flux that underlies it.
It's sort of a thing, but I can't see a Star of David in this at all.
Right at the centre. There is right at the centre a little blue star.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah, I can't see that. Yeah.
Yeah, so this, it's right at the centre, but it's the smallest point of the diagram. Okay, so it's...
Yes, I see. Yeah, about the playing, which means that it can play between wave and particle.
Yes.
But once you go, all right, let's superimpose that model onto that one.
You freeze it.
You're fixing it.
You fix it and it stops, right?
But so then maybe in your imagination you could play with.
You could play with it in your imagination, right? Yeah. But that's right, and you can hold the thing. You can hold them loosely in a kind of playful way together and see what happens. My problem with the Tree of Life thing, when Benny asked me about it, is because there is this thought around the Tree of, this is the model, this is the super model. And it isn't. No model is any better than any other model, because actually any model is trying to teach us is a way of dialoguing, a way of communicating between the surface and the depth. And so in a sense, you see, what we're playing with, the principles that we're playing with, that you find in so we have this letter shin that represents anything, everything, wild factor, random factor, and that's at the heart of everything. And that's the thing that in a way that we keep surrendering back into. And then there are these kind of principles that we work with. So we work with this principle of intention or will that you find in the letter Yod. We'll work with the capacity of the of that mirror-like womb that you find in the letter He. We work with the sense of kind of dialogue and fusion and energy that you get and joining together that you get in the letter Vav. And the principle of embodiment that you find in the He final. So and we're playing with these things. So, do you want it again, Becky?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've only got two in my head.
Okay.
Principle of embodiment and principle of intention.
Right, so you meant the two in the middle. Right, so the first one is the principle of letter yod with the principle of intention, will. The second is the imagination. It's the capacity to create the image. The third thing is a capacity to join together and to infuse with life, which is the letter Vav. And then the final piece is the embodiment.
That's what you said about flow, crystallization and...
energy. So flow, so another way to put it was intention, flow, energy and crystallization.
Flow is imagination.
Flow, I would say, is imagination, because flow is the capacity for something moving in a different direction, which then later emerges as image or possibility. Okay, so in a sense, what you could say is the intention sets up a field of flow that's moving in a particular direction, that acquires energy and density, and then expresses itself in some form or other.
Sorry, which one's will there in?
Will is the letter Yud.
Yud.
Yeah.
So in a way, no model is any good if you don't meet it with a specific intention.
Yes. Intention is the pivotal place. Well, there's two things. Well, the first thing, of course, is holding yourself in the place where you're in relationship to the letter Shin, which represents that kind of mystery. But from that mystery, intention is the key place. Intention then leads to, if you like, the creation of pattern and flow, which is the basis of image, which in a way, as the image acquires energy from the letter, and life in a sense, from the letter Vav, it then embodies itself in actual tangible form in the final letter Hey. So that's the kind of that's the sort of process that keeps getting repeated. And there is an interesting in the structure of the name. There is an interesting relationship between the letter Yud and the letter Vav, because structurally, if you look at the letter Vav is actually an extension of the letter Yud. So it's an extension of that will. It's that will extended a given energy and coming into dialogue. The two letter Hays, of course, are reflections of each other. So there's a way in which embodiment and imagination are the same thing at different levels.
Do you go around it in a certain pattern?
You can do. You can go around it. So basically, so normally it's Yud He Vav He, right? So that's how it's spelled. But you can, and one of the things the Kabbalists like to do is to randomize the letters. So that's one pattern. Another pattern could be He Yud Vav He. What would that be like? Right? So you can play with the letters. The Shin is always in the center and wrapped around. But these components, you can arrange them in different possibilities.
You can do
any of those. You can jump across, there's 12 different ways of permutating those letters. Right? So for example, if we took the if we did it this way for a moment, if we did crystallization leading to energy, leading to will, leading to imagination, which would be He, Vav, Yud, He. Now that would be another pattern. That would be something else to play with. So what would that be? So if you imagine sort of embodiment in that sense, embracing embodiment, coming into energy, finding the will underneath the energy, which invigorates the imagination. So it could mean, in a way, that's almost like, if you look at the picture, okay, find the energy of the picture, come into relationship with the intention that produces the picture, which then invigorates your own imagination. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like an alchemical process, but in a way, there's no, not a fixed.
No, there's lots of different ways to do it.
You could do this first, and then that.
Yeah, that's the point in a way. You can play with these things back and forth. And the more you the more playful you are with it, the more you discover.
And you talked about, I think yesterday, something about models of change.
Yeah.
They're fourfold.
Yeah.
Or most have four components.
Well, I think there's something, I thought I was looking at this idea of, that you have, is this yeah, four is a kind of balance, equal is both actually with the four in relationship to the unconditioned. So you normally have this idea of fourfoldness and circularity, where you've got, which is the same thing as the shin and the four letters, where you've got this sense of stable form or set of processes that's also in relationship to something that's beyond any form. And that creates, the two together create this dynamic revolving set of forms. Which is what this is. The great tragedy of it, of course, is these traditions ended up embedded in religious tradition, cultural or religious traditions, where that playful thing gets lost altogether. So the creative edge vanishes completely. And sadly, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which actually is this creative, playful, energetic process, ends up as the figure of Jehovah. So if we think of the degradation, so Jehovah is this horrible old bloke who sits in the cloud, sort of punishing people for not doing as they're told. So that ancient, the ancient image of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, actually, which is becomes the total antithesis, is the antithesis of Jehovah, but ends up related to be Jehovah. And one of the critical things that happened in Jewish history is when they substituted the word Adonai for the word Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Because they never, Orthodox Jew will never say Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, not even the letters. They will say Adonai, which means Lord. And it completely, once you say that, you completely make yourself servant, you create a servant-master relationship to something that's a cooperative, playful, energetic set of patterns.
This is what Orthodox does.
Yeah, always. It's the creation of the idol, because you end up as the service of the idol. So and it happens with all forms, and in this particular form, it's ended up as the monstrous Jehovah figure, you know, whom William Blake called Nobodaddy, the kind of oppressive kind of male archetype somewhere. Whereas actually, if you look at the sort of gender of the letters of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, it would be a sort of transgender. If there was a being based on this, they'd be a hermaphroditic transgender sort of person.
Young old.
Yeah, young old, mixed gender. Mm. Eternally creative, trying on new dresses all the time. Yeah, because that would be its nature.
This is what happened to Western Chan when John died. He took that wild card.
Yeah. And then it becomes, well, as you and I know, it then becomes ossified and becomes formal. In fact, in that case, it became formal Chinese and lost a lot of the creative energy that was underneath it. And in a sense, you know, that's sort of the crucial thing, really. As long as we hold to that intention for a mystery, the intention to be creative, and then we do need a form, or at least I do, I need a form that holds some of that for me, I suppose, and there's lots of forms, we've looked at lots of forms. I suppose what I'm showing you this time, and we'll continue to look at over the next couple of weekends, is the forms that are most essential to me, the ones that I've never yet worn out, in a sense, and if I got fed up with them at times and abandoned them, I end up coming back to them because there's something they hold for me that I don't find in other places. And then, just as we finish, is there any burning questions? I want to go on and tell you a story, really, about that's related. But let's see if there's any questions about this that I haven't covered before we finish.
One observation.
Yeah.
You said the Kabbalah meant the whispering between the worlds.
Yeah.
The runes are whispered secrets.
Ah, same sort of thing. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Ah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Because it's the same idea, you see. It is that it is something that is transmitted in a, as a whisper, but between, you know, this has that sense of betweenness in it. Okay, so I just want to finish with a story that will also come back to the idea of those very sharp visualizations that I did with you. Now, when you study the Kabbalah and you're from South Wales and you study with a Kabbalist from Chelmsford, you don't necessarily feel as authentic as somebody who might be brought up in Judaism and is steeped in Hebrew tradition. In fact, you're very conscious of the fact that you don't really understand Hebrew. And so you maybe don't feel very authentic. And I mean, that is a problem anyway, to be honest, is just coming out of where I came from. But certainly when I started working in Israel, in Jerusalem, not just Israel, but Jerusalem. So this is Ian, the Buddhist Kabbalist, goes to Jerusalem, 2001. And one of the things I was excited by the possibility is that I find an authentic Kabbalist teacher. Which I meant, of course, a Jew who spoke Hebrew and would come teach me the real kind of mysteries. I did find somebody, but she was completely unlike anything I could have imagined. Most of the people I came across who looked like the people who would have it, the old guys with big beards and they were appalling. They were kind of horrible, racist, conventionally religious people who didn't seem to understand innerness at all. I'm sure there are. I'm not dismissing all the Jews of Israel. I'm just talking about the people I met. But in terms of what was accessible, I found a lot of cultic behaviour, kind of a Jewish version of Kabbalah version of fundamentalism, really. Well, the other thing I found is very superstitious thing. Guys who wanted to sell me red threads to tie around my wrist and sell me spells to make myself successful. And so that was kind of disappointing, but interesting. And it taught me things about looking, trust what you have and don't look in other places and don't project out so much. I learned quite a lot about that. But then I did meet this very interesting woman. As a result of my friend Yaqub Ibn Yusuf, who is a Jewish Sufi originally from Brooklyn, and who still runs a New Age bookshop in Jerusalem, the only New Age bookshop in Jerusalem. And he took me to see this woman called Colette. Have I told you this story before? Can't remember. No? Okay, so Colette she's now dead, she lived until she was 94, was a Jewish woman from French extraction from Morocco, who used to open a house on Saturday evenings after Shabbat had ended, for people to come and sit with her, and she was this extraordinary old woman with very tall, very elegant, in her 90s, and had the most upright carriage. And had an extraordinary, she's very aristocratic and was very intimidating. So a bunch of us used to go and pile into Colette's house. So I used to go there every time I was in Israel, which in those days I was going there about 3 or 4 times a year. So I sort of went along to see Colette for quite a few years, really. And what she would do with us, she would get us to sit in a particular way. She would get us to sit in a way that was very upright. And she would talk about aligning our bones. And she would then do these really rapid meditations, just like I did earlier. And they were very confusing to me, I definitely didn't really understand them, but they had an effect upon me. And I was a bit, and she, I was looking for somebody who was going to talk about the mysteries of the Tree of Life and talk about Kabbalistic texts. And she wouldn't do anything like that. She was a very annoying woman. And you asked a question, then she'd shoot you down. She was icy hauteur, really, because she was this French-Jewish aristocrat from an ancient family, and sort of, and she would just shoot you down in flames, really, and sort of. And she was very, very focused on working with these very rapid images that actually really woke you up. So this kind of, and part of their nature is that kind of shocking quality, because they're intended. I mean, she also, you know, at other times did some very gentle things as well, but this was not a defining feature of her work. She worked a lot with the idea of will and image. And a sharp will and a sharp image that disrupted you. So you'd go away feeling pissed off, stirred up, but she was catalytic in her work. And her full name was Colette Albuquerque Muscat. And she was a truly remarkable teacher somewhere, and she definitely taught Kabbalah, but she taught the simplest form of Kabbalah you can imagine, because actually she's working with these four principles of will. And she didn't teach me these things, she didn't teach anybody, she just went to her house and she did the meditations, except for the one time, the last time that I ever saw her, which because she died about a month afterwards. And I was just lucky to be there. This is her last ever public teaching. She became ill the week afterwards. And I'm now going to... So this woman who just gave you these meditations, which kind of did you in somewhat, you know, suddenly announces, I'm now going to give you the teaching. And it's bloody hell, right? Aren't we the lucky... Everybody's feeling immediately privileged, and I knew it. I knew I was ready for this. You know, so suddenly pride is blasting out all over, as well as excitement. And so this is it. So this is the heart of all my teaching. As we're all sitting there. Brilliant. And she's got a very precise, she can speak much more precisely than I can, and she said, Ha Otsem Matvia Al Otsemen. The bone points to itself. Thank you. That was it. I can't really convey to you how powerful it was. I mean, for God's sense at all. And it's sort of, because it's so you're all kind of thinking, right, book's ready, and kind of. And she says this phrase, which I'm sort of thinking, what would you say? And sort of, the energetic kind of effect of it was very striking. It sort of cut, this was the nature of her teaching, she cut through things. I mean, she was powerful, very tricky, difficult person, really. And it's interesting, because I've noticed in recent years people have written various books based on her teachings, and then mainly lists of the exercises she used to give, which are nice, and they're okay. But they miss the central point, really. Because the central point of her teaching was the bone points to itself. And I'll work, tell you more about it next time. We'll look at it in combination with coming back to some of this. We'll look at it in a bit more detail. But in a nutshell, it's a code. Now, the Hebrew is a language which is a very concentrated language. So this was a woman really summing up her life's work in one sentence. And it takes me quite a long time to unpack it. But I do feel I've got there enough anyway. There's lots more to discover about it, I think. But the first letter He means the. It also means breath. And it also means it also can mean Ruach HaKadesh, the holy breath. So it can also be the letter Shin. Otzem, which is the word that means bone.
What's the word?
Otzem, in Hebrew. Don't worry, I'll give it to you next time in Hebrew. But we don't have much time now. It means bone, but it also means the essence. Mitzviah means to point, it means directionality. Al, or all, is a word of conjunction. It means to, joining with. Otsamen, the word that means itself, is also, it's the word otsem, with a letter, with an added letter, a letter of completion. So in a certain way, what she is spelling out are the letters of the name. The letter He, the first letter, represents the shin. The bone or the essence of things is the will, which is right, because at the heart of everything is an intention. An intention to be, an intention to generate, an intention to, that things are built upon. The word metzvia, which is the activity, it's the flow that arises out of the letter, is of course the letter He. The word all, which is the word of joining, getting near to, is the letter Vav. An otsamen, which is the bone, the image expressed, the will of the bone expressed in form, is the final He. Now, when you do this, in a sense, what happens when I do the exercise? The very short, whether so, I have to align to this, to the deep place, which is the shin. There is this word they call kavana, which is intention. And as I align to the intention, which is the intention of doing an exercise, making an offering of whatever kind, what appears then is the image. The breath is the energizing principle, and the final place of opening your eyes is the place where you suddenly bring it out. So this mechanism, this very sharp kind of mechanism, so you, okay, and you see the whole exercise has that in it. Okay, pay attention, breathe in, breathe in, out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. We're establishing kind of attention. Then the image, the Zelim. See that. Breathe in, breathe out as you're seeing it. Give it energy, give it life, bring it to birth within you. Open your eyes. Manifest the image. There's lots of other ways to do it, and there's lots of other ways to interpret those four words. But it's the thing about it, the thing that's most important about it, and why I learned things from Colette, even though I've never had a single personal conversation, well, I did have a single personal conversation, it didn't go very well. She basically dismissed me as not worthy of her attention, really, you know, slunk out of the room. But that didn't matter, really, because actually the dialogue was at a much deeper kind of a level. And there's something about the mystery that, you know, that actually she did sum up her entire bloody teaching in those four words. Even though it was very disappointing and kind of annoying, you know, the result of it in me was it hung around a minute. If she had given me more tangible teaching, it would have been more interesting and maybe a bit more flattering or something. But the irritating notion of being given the four bloody words that as a non-Hebrew speaker didn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, but yet, of course, summed up the whole of somebody's work, and the energy of it summed up her life's work. It was extraordinary, really. And the other weird thing about me and Colette is the very first time I went to Israel, Ali and I were in Israel together. We stayed in a hostel in East Jerusalem. I met a woman who turned out to be a friend of Jeff Johnson. You know Jeff Johnson, don't you? Right, turned out to be a friend of Jeff Johnson. And she was going to see this woman called Colette Albuquerque Muscat, who taught a Kabbalah of light, and I didn't like the sound of it at all. It sounded really weird and simplistic. And so very oddly, the very first time I went to Israel, I came across somebody who'd encountered Colette. And it's just, I mean, life is generally mysterious, you know, because, I mean, I suppose having discovered Colette, it's not a surprise every time I went back again, I wanted to see her, because I was curious about her. But there weren't a load of us there that last night. And by that time, I was only going a couple of times a year, I think. So it was very extraordinary that I happened to be there. And that, and in a way, what her teaching did, the other thing it did to me, was take me right back to the things I'd learned from my first teacher, Tom Ollerman. But I had to piece that together for myself. So I had to take seriously, okay, here's this teaching, it's very powerful, very mysterious, and somewhere it's directing me right back to my own beginnings. So I suppose really what we're doing now, and what I'm interested in doing and continuing to do these last few weekends, is stay very close to the bones, to look at this dynamic of the bones and the flesh, to look at the intention, the imagination, the bringing of things to life and the embodying of things. Because as we sort of inquire together, much more will come out around that, really, you know. So this is a, you know, and in a way that the great thing about something that's quite simple but has a lot compressed within it is there's lots of possibilities that can arise. She was so horrible, Colette. Oh, God. She was lovely, and she was horrible. She had a thing about, I think she's wrong about, she wouldn't let anybody cross their bloody legs. She felt it was wrong to cross your legs. Which meant you're sitting, there's like a tiny little room, it's much smaller than this, you're all sitting in the middle, so you're sitting there like that, because you're not allowed to cross your legs. And kind of, but it did an interesting, I mean, I do a disservice, it was a bit horrible, but actually what it did was to put you in that slightly stressed, slightly woken up, but that was the kind of atmosphere she created around herself, and that was her nature somewhere. So that was that.
She wouldn't approve of us in our group on our comfy sofas.
She wouldn't. Although she herself used to enjoy reclining, but she used to recline on this wonderful daybed. And actually, she's regarded as a living treasure of Jerusalem. And so in the Hebrew Museum in Jerusalem, they've actually set up a replica of her room.
Freud's kind of room.
Yeah, like that, very like that. So she's regarded, she's got that kind of status in Israel. And sort of, so if you're ever in Jerusalem in the Hebrew Museum, you can go and see the room I used to sit in. It's obviously what she felt. I mean, this was an expression of her. This was this very, very, she was not a comfortable person, right? You know, she was like a knife blade. She was very thin. She was very clear. In a way, and that was the expression of her nature, I think, somewhere. When she'd been brought up in quite an odd way by her father, and kind of, which had produced remarkable abilities, but she certainly wasn't a comfortable, very prickly person, and very autocratic person, and so that was her expressing her nature. I mean, I am totally different from her, I would never do it that way, but I can see that was her expressing her in that sense.
Sounds like my friend Lillian.
Yes, Lillian's. Definitely
autocratic, knows the right way, you know. It's a huge strength and a huge weakness, really.
Yes, it is.
And fantastic directional focus.
Yeah, but as you say, but you can't let other things in, and I guess that would have been Colette's kind of defect as well. Actually, she is quite like Lillian, now that I think about it. Same body shape, very thin, yeah. Tall body.
It's John Crook was like that, and the same body build.
Was he? Isn't that interesting?
Because that was his shadow, was that very autocratic?
Yeah. Anyway, let's just take a breath, guys, and just pause. We're just about to finish. We'll just literally sit for a minute together. Thank you all very much. It's been tremendously pleasurable to be with you, and thank you for rescuing me from the world of radiotherapy. It's been just really nice to be doing something completely different and something I really love with people I love, really. So thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.